Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the July 26, 2024 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week has a single raised clenched fist just from the shirt sleeve up against a bright sky blue background. It's Donald Trump's fist, and there's blood running down it, staining the cuff of his shirt, dripping off. And the headline is Bloodshed. An assassination attempt on Trump tests a divided nation. Not surprisingly, that shows up a number of times today, first up in the first main story. Calls for unity after Trump assassination attempt. What happened? A shocked and divided nation was on the edge this week after a gunman tried to kill Donald Trump at a campaign rally, coming so close to assassinating the former president that a bullet nicked Trump's ear. The GOP presidential nominee was 6 minutes into a speech at a fairground in Butler, Pennsylvania, when a shooter, 20-year-old Thomas Matthew Crooks, opened fire with an AR-15-style rifle from a rooftop some 150 yards from the stage. In the ensuing chaos, Trump hit the floor and was swarmed by Secret Service agents who hustled him into an SUV, but only after Trump, blood streaming from his ear, turned to the crowd, pumped his fist, and repeatedly yelled, "Fight!" Secret Service sniper killed Crooks. The would-be Trump assassin shot dead one rallygoer, firefighter Corey Comparatore, and wounded two others. Crooks, a nursing home employee from suburban Pittsburgh, also had explosives in his car. He left no clues about his motive. High school classmates called him a quiet, oft-bully loner. Investigators said Crooks hadn't publicly proclaimed any political opinions. The Homeland Security Inspector General launched an investigation of the Secret Service's actions at the rally as questions swirled about how Crooks was able to scale a building with a clear line of sight to Trump. The lapse came after Trump's security detail was bolstered due to an alleged Iranian plot to assassinate him. Several audience members said they watched Crooks with alarm and tried to alert police. "We started hollering to cops. Hey, he's right there," said attendee Mike DeFrisia. Secret Service Director Kimberly Cheadle said it was the job of local police to secure the building, which lay outside the security perimeter. But security experts say ultimate responsibility fell on the agency. Some Republican lawmakers called on Cheadle to resign. President Biden condemned the shooting in a primetime address, calling the election run-up a national time of testing and asking Americans to lower the temperature. Trump posted "Unite America" on social media and said he'd reworked his Republican convention speech to focus on unity. But some Republican lawmakers blamed Biden and Democrats for the shooting. Before being named as Trump's running mate, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance said Biden campaign's anti-Trump rhetoric led directly to the attack, while Representative Mike Collins said Biden should be prosecuted for incitement. "Joe Biden sent the orders," said Collins. What the editorial said: "This is a shocking and perilous moment for America," said the Los Angeles Times. "It should be a time for Americans to condemn violence with one voice. Instead, the shooting threatens to further divide this deeply polarized nation. Where we go from here depends in part on our leaders. Rather than use the shooting to rile up their base, Trump and top Republicans must recognize that the U.S. is a powder keg right now and tamp down the heated rhetoric before it can spark. This was an attack on American democracy, said National Review. The pressure should be on Democrats to rethink their fevered insistence that a second Trump term would be the equivalent of the Third Reich, which sends the dangerous message that any means of resistance is justified. Meanwhile, the Secret Service must face some hard questions about how a rifle-toting assassin was able to scale a roof in open view and fire off shots that brought us within inches of a national calamity. What the columnist said. After days of intensive investigation, Crooks remains an enigma, said Michael Bistecker and Associated Press. The intelligent introvert had scant social media presence and gave no hints of strong political beliefs. He was a registered Republican, but also gave $15 to a progressive PAC on Biden's inauguration day. With no manifesto and no clues on his cell phone or computer, the mystery of why he opened fire on Trump is as elusive as the moment it happened. With his astounding show of strength under fire, Trump proved himself a pure warrior, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post. Popping his fist before an American flag, the bloodied candidate justified his supporters' enormous faith in his leadership and likely won himself the election. Compare that to the stumbling Biden, who was justifiably condemned for saying before the shooting that it was time to put a bullseye on Trump. Such over-the-top rhetoric put Trump in the crosshairs. Behold the MAGA playbook, said Ruth Ben-Ghiet in her Substack newsletter. They'll leverage the shooting to claim that anyone who calls out Trump's authoritarian agendas is inciting violence. But Trump's threat to the Republic can't be downplayed, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. He stokes and feeds upon a lust for violence, brands his opponents communist and vermin, and calls for his critics' execution. He's not to blame for the shooting, but is responsible for the widespread fear of reprisals and chaos in its wake. America is staring into the abyss, said Edward Luce in Financial Times. Violence was already implicit in much of the rhetoric heating up the election year. Now it is explicit. A bullet came within inches of killing a presidential candidate, who in turn is vowing retribution if he is returned to the White House. It's too early to speculate on how this event might affect Trump's already favorable prospects in November, but it is fair to say that an already existential election is now considerably more fraught than before. And the controversy of the week, same topic. Political violence. Is this who we are? In an appeal for national unity following the attempted assassination of Donald Trump, President Biden declared that such political violence is not who we are as a nation. But is it? Asked Julian E. Zalazar in Foreign Policy. Of the 45 people who have served as president, four were murdered in office. Abraham Lincoln, James Garfield, William McKinley, and John F. Kennedy. Three others, FDR, Gerald Ford, and Ronald Reagan, would have joined that list if their would-be assassins had been better shots. And Trump isn't the first presidential candidate to be targeted. He joins Robert Kennedy, assassinated in 1968, George Wallace, shot and paralyzed in 1972, and former President Teddy Roosevelt, whose life was saved in 1912 by a 50-page campaign speech in his coat pocket, which slowed his would-be killer's bullets. Let's not forget the murders of political figures such as Martin Luther King Jr. and Harvey Milk, or the near-fatal shooting of Representative Gabby Giffords in 2011 and Representative Steve Scalise in 2017. It's a president's job to remind us of our better natures, said Jeremy Suri in Time. But any serious reckoning with the scourge of political violence needs to acknowledge that the attempt on former President Trump's life fits all too well into America's violent history. If anything, it's getting worse, said David A. Graham in The Atlantic. In the last few years, we've entered a terrible new era of political violence, the most serious incident being the January 6 U.S. Capitol riot, when an angry mob tried to block the certification of a fair election and maybe hang the vice president in the process. There was also the 2020 kidnapping plot against Michigan's Democratic governor, Gretchen Whitmer, a 2022 plot to murder conservative Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, and that year's near-fatal hammer attack on Paul Pelosi, husband of then-House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The problem is systemic, said Kyle Chaney and Josh Gerstein in Politico. Death threats are now facts of the job for members of Congress, judges, and local and state officials charged with overseeing elections. There is a way out, said Rachel Kleinfeld, also in Politico. Horrific though it was, the spectacle of a presidential candidate getting wounded by a bullet on live TV could be a shock to the system that leads regular Americans to realize that they need to stand up against political violence. That may sound utopian, but we're already seeing a resurgence of moderation in France, Poland, and Brazil, with citizens on the center-left and center-right standing together to demand a different kind of political society. But we have a lot more firearms than those countries, said David Dayan in The American Prospect. America will live with the threat of political violence as long as rogues and troubled loners can get a gun pretty much at will. Guns are one unique American problem, said David Frum in The Atlantic. Trump is another. Yes, the horror of last week is a continuation of the bloodshed that has stained every page of American political history. But it's also true that Trump has embraced political violence more successfully than any other American leader, spurring his supporters to attack and intimidate opponents. That in no way justifies his attempted assassination, said Nick Cotoggio in The Dispatch. We can't murder our way to a healthier America. But cooling our political rhetoric, as we must, does not mean refraining from speaking the truth, that Trump, in his own way, is an enemy of democracy, just like the worm who tried to kill him. And our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for grateful living, after a Harvard study found that among women ages 69 to 96, those who reported themselves most thankful for their lives had a 9% lower all-cause mortality rate than the less grateful. Gratitude is powerful, said co-author Tyler Vanderweel. It was a good week for omens, after J.D. Vance's hometown was pounded by golf ball-sized hail just minutes after the GOP senator was named Donald Trump's running mate. The hail in Middletown, Ohio was so intense, reports the New York Times, that it cleared parks as people fled for cover. It was a good week for positivity after an English soccer fan had England Euro 2024 winners tattooed on his leg 2 days before England's 2-1 defeat to Spain in the Euro final. Dan Thomas said he had no regrets and would simply change the 4 to an 8 when England wins in 2028. But it was a bad week for anthems. After country star Ingrid Andres singing the Star Spangled Banner before MLB's annual Home Run Derby delivered a performance so inebriated and off-key that she promptly checked herself into rehab and apologized on Instagram to MLB, all the fans, and this country I love so much for that rendition. It's a bad week for the comfort of strangers after police in Orange County, California, warned residents that robbers are approaching pedestrians, asking for a hug, then violently stripping those who consent of jewelry. Finally, it was a bad week for claustrophobia after a man in the Indian state of Kerala was trapped in a stuck hospital elevator for 42 hours before his plight was finally discovered by an elevator operator. "I slept in a corner," said Ravindran Nair, 59, "and used another corner to pee and poo." Moving on to the briefing, title this week is Paris Olympic Moment. The Summer Games return to the City of Lights this month, 100 years after it last hosted the global competition. Is Paris ready for the Games? French President Emmanuel Macron says it is, insisting the Olympics will be a formidable moment of French pride. And coming just weeks after bitterly fought elections that resulted in a hung parliament, France could do with such a unifying event. Organizers say the revolutionary games will bring the nation together without all the usual wasteful spending. Costing an estimated $9.5 billion, less than any Olympics for 30 years, the games will kick off July 26 with an opening ceremony in which 10,000 athletes on 100 boats will float down the Seine. At least 300,000 people will watch from the waterside, several times the number who usually get to see an Olympics parade in a stadium. Only two new permanent sports venues have been built: an 8,000-seat arena in the poor northern neighborhood of Port de la Chapelle, and an aquatic center in a nearby suburb. Most sports will be held in existing venues or in temporary facilities next to Parisian landmarks, like the beach volleyball court in front of the Eiffel Tower. "The entire city has been turned into a vast Olympic stadium," said Tony Estanguet, head of the Paris Organizing Committee. What challenges do organizers face? With 15 million visitors expected, security is a major concern. Islamist terrorists have attacked Paris repeatedly over the past two decades, and authorities say they've already foiled one Olympic plot, arresting an Islamic State sympathizer who allegedly planned to target a soccer game. Defending the opening ceremony, which will stretch for nearly 4 miles, will require a very complex security operation that won't eliminate all the risk, said Bertrand Cavalier, a former commander at France's National Military Police Training School. Drones could strike from the sky, shooters could fire from windows, bombs could be planted in tunnels beneath the river. To minimize the threats, the airspace over and around Paris will be closed for the ceremony. Cars won't be allowed to enter areas bordering the Seine for days, and the 20,000 Parisians who live and work there will need a QR code to enter. Some 45,000 police and military officers will flood the city, about 10 times the typical deployment. Macron has said the ceremony could relocate to a stadium in case of a threat, but officials are reluctant to give up their open-air dreams. "If we don't do it because we're afraid," said Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo, "then the terrorists have won." What's new at the games? Breaking, better known as breakdancing, will make its Olympic debut some 50 years after it originated in the Bronx. 32 breakers, 16 B-girls and 16 B-boys will compete, contorting their bodies into gravity-defying shapes as they improvise to a DJ's beat. "There's no doubt in my mind this is a sport," said Team USA breaker Sonny Choi, 35. "Dance, art, sport, altogether. Skateboarding, sports climbing, and surfing will return for their second Olympics. But the surfers won't bring their boards to Paris. Instead, they'll hit the waves on Tahiti in the overseas territory of French Polynesia, 10 time zones and nearly 10,000 miles from the French capital. Could doping taint these Olympics? The International Testing Agency says it will deploy a raft of new high-tech tools to catch dopers, including artificial intelligence models that can identify unusual results. But many athletes worry cheaters will get past these safeguards. The World Anti-Doping Agency is under fire after it was recently revealed that 23 Chinese swimmers tested positive for a banned heart medication before Tokyo's 2021 Olympics, but were still allowed to compete. The athletes won 3 gold medals and 11 are set to swim in Paris. The WADA never investigated, instead relying on China's explanation that the athletes inadvertently consumed the drug after it got into spice containers in a hotel kitchen. I think our faith in the system is at an all-time low, said American swimmer Katie Ledecky, a 7-time Olympic champion. Are there other concerns? The SAN is meant to host swimming and triathlon races, but pollution there threatens those plans. Despite a $1.5 billion cleanup effort, organizers canceled a ceremony rehearsal last month, citing dangerous levels of fecal bacteria in the water. Samples taken showed E. coli levels 10 times greater than the amount permitted by the World Triathlon Federation. Readings have since improved, and Hidalgo and Estanguet took a plunge in the Seine this week to show its cleanliness. The water is wonderful, Hidalgo said, after swimming about 330 feet. Very cool and very nice. How are Parisians handling all this? In typical French fashion, by protesting. Workers at the National Mint, tasked with making Olympic medals, have staged a strike to demand higher wages, while police officers have protested about overtime pay and lost vacation days. The greatest pushback has come from residents angry about disruptions to their lives. And despite claims of socially responsible event, police have cleared migrant tent encampments along the Seine, so tourists won't have to see the bad people, said Ba Dak, a South Sudanese asylum seeker who was displaced multiple times. Activists have called this social cleansing, but athletes and politicians have urged residents to embrace the Olympic moment. The moaning has to stop, said French tennis star Yannick Noah. It's going to be beautiful. And into the best columns, we'll read two from the U.S. Ian Milheiser from Vox writes, an inept court creates legal chaos. The conservative Supreme Court justices are not just radical and corrupt, said Ian Milheiser. They're ostentatiously bad at their jobs. The recent decisions have been so incompetently drafted, they've plunged the rest of the court system into confusion. A deluge of challenges based on those vague rulings is gumming up the courts and producing ridiculous and immoral outcomes. The 2022 overturning of Roe activated a flurry of extremist state abortion bans that left doctors and hospitals afraid to save lives of dying pregnant women. The Bruen gun ruling invented a historical tradition test that has baffled judges across the political spectrum and triggered hundreds of gun law challenges. In a recent tortured clarification, the court stated that new gun laws must be relevantly similar to 18th century gun laws. Pure gobbledygook. Then the justices overturned the Chevron precedent, giving themselves vast new powers over all federal regulations, even though they can barely handle their own shrinking caseload. Finally, the court defied the Constitution in inventing near total immunity for presidents from all laws, opening the door to autocracy, murder, and oppression. These reckless justices are acting like Donald Trump with a law degree. Ignoring the science on trans care. Why are Biden administration agencies and medical associations still ignoring the science on gender-affirming care for minors? Asked Pamela Paul. 3 months ago, a comprehensive assessment commissioned by the UK's National Health Service concluded that the use of puberty blockers, hormones, and surgery did not ease the psychological distress of most teens with gender identity issues, and that these issues usually resolve over time without medical treatment. The report by pediatrician Hilary Cass led the British government to issue an emergency ban on puberty blockers, and medical societies throughout Europe are moving away from the medical approach. But in the U.S., the American Medical Association and other medical groups have ignored or dismissed the Cass review, and the Biden administration still endorses gender-affirming care for adolescents. That's because they've been intimidated by transgender activists' insistence that all contrary evidence is transphobic. So, minors continue to receive interventions that leave them with lifelong infertility, sexual dysfunction, and other medical problems. In other words, the U.S. continues to put ideology ahead of science. This column is from Jamaica. An early storm is a late omen. Jamaica might have been spared the worst of Hurricane Beryl, but on a warming planet, there will be more to come, said Ralston Nimbard. Never before in our collective memories have we experienced a Category 5 hurricane forming so early in the season. Beryl killed 8 people and destroyed more than $6.4 million in infrastructure, flattening crops, knocking out power, and straining our public services. And it wasn't even a direct hit. Such consequences of an increasingly hotter planet are being disproportionately borne by island nations like ours, who contribute little to carbon pollution. Rising sea levels engulf low-lying areas. Constant droughts dry up crops. Fueling this fire are the authoritarian governments of China and Russia, with a carbon footprint as big as Godzilla's, and a disdain for any discussion of limiting fossil fuels. And now we're threatened with a second Trump administration. As president, Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord, and if reelected, he could well hasten the world's drift toward the tipping point. Americans must wake up before it is too late and elect leaders who prioritize the fight against climate change. Otherwise, our children and grandchildren will become mere fried chickens on a burning planet. And time for our feature article, The Last Word. The Secrets of Late Bloomers. Our society is relentlessly focused on early success, said David Brooks in The Atlantic. But many of history's greatest minds found their paths only after years of wandering. Paul Cézanne always knew he wanted to be an artist. His father compelled him to enter law school, but after two desultory years, he withdrew. In 1861, at the age of 22, he went to Paris to pursue his artistic dreams, but was rejected by the École des Beaux-Arts, struggled as a painter, and retreated back to his hometown in the south of France, where he worked as a clerk in his father's bank. He returned to Paris the next year and was turned down again by the École. His paintings were rejected by the Salon de Paris every year from 1864 to 1869. He continued to submit paintings until 1882, but none were accepted. He joined with the Impressionists, many of whose works were also being rejected, but soon stopped showing with them at all. By middle age, he was discouraged. He wrote to a friend, "On this matter, I must tell you that the numerous studies to which I devoted myself have produced only negative results, and dreading criticism that is only too justified, I have resolved to work in silence until the day when I should feel capable of defending theoretically the results of my endeavors." No Cézanne paintings were put on public display when he was between 46 and 56. In 1886, when Cézanne was 47, the celebrated writer Émile Zola, the artist's closest friend since adolescence, published a novel called The Ouvreur. It was about two young men, one who grows up to be a famous author, and the other who grows up to be a failed painter and commits suicide. The painter character was based, at least in part, on Cézanne. Things began to turn around in 1895, when, at the age of 56, Cézanne had his first one-man show. 2 years later, one of his paintings was purchased by a museum in Berlin, the first time any museum had shown that kind of interest in his work. By the time he was 60, his paintings had started selling, though for much lower prices than those fetched by Manet or Renoir. Soon he was famous, revered. Fellow artists made pilgrimages to watch him work. What drove the man through all those decades of setbacks and obscurity? One biographer attributed it to his inquietude, his drive, restlessness, anxiety. He just kept pushing himself to get better. His continual sense of dissatisfaction was evident in a letter he wrote to his son in 1906, at age 67, a month before he died. "I want to tell you that, as a painter, I am becoming more clairvoyant to nature, but that it is always very difficult for me to realize my feelings. I cannot reach the intensity that unfolds before my senses. I do not possess that wonderful richness of color that animates nature." He was still at it on the day he died, still working on his paintings, still teaching himself to improve. The year after his death, a retrospective of his work was mounted in Paris. Before long, he would be widely recognized as one of the founders of modern art. Cézanne is the father of us all, both Matisse and Picasso are said to have declared. Today we live in a society structured to promote early bloomers. Our school system has sorted people by the time they are 18 using grades and SAT scores. Some of these people zoom to prestigious academic launching pads, while others get left behind. Many of our most prominent models of success made it big while young. Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, Taylor Swift, Michael Jordan. "Young people are just smarter," Zuckerberg once said, impossibly the dumbest statement in American history. "There are no second acts in American lives," F. Scott Fitzgerald once observed, in what might be the next dumbest. But for many people, the talents that bloom later in life are more consequential than the ones that bloom early. A 2019 study by researchers in Denmark found that, on average, Nobel Prize winners made their crucial discoveries at the age of 44. Even brilliant people apparently need at least a couple of decades to master their field. Successful late bloomers are all around us. Morgan Freeman had his breakthrough roles in Street Smart and Driving Miss Daisy in his early 50s. Isaac Dennison published the book that established her literary reputation, Out of Africa, at 52. Morris Chang founded Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing, the world's leading chip maker, at 55. Copernicus came up with his theory of planetary motion in his 60s. Why do some people hit their peak later than others? In his book, Late Bloomers, the journalist Rich Karlgaard points out that this is really two questions. First, why didn't these people bloom earlier? Second, what traits or skills did they possess that enabled them to bloom late? It turns out that late bloomers are not simply early bloomers or delayed timetable. Late bloomers tend to be qualitatively different, possessing a different set of abilities that are mostly invisible to or discouraged by our current education system. People like Cezanne or Alfred Hitchcock or Charles Darwin regard their entire lives as experiments. Their focus is not on their finished work, which they often toss away haphazardly. It is on the process of learning itself. Am I closer to understanding, to mastering? They live their lives as a long period of trial and error, trying this and trying that, a slow process of accumulation and elaboration, so that the quality of their work peaks late in life. Let's look at some of the traits that tend to distinguish late bloomers from early bloomers, the qualities that cause them to lag early in life, but surge ahead over the long haul. Intrinsic motivation. Most of our schools and workplaces are built around extrinsic motivation. If you work hard, you will be rewarded with good grades, better salaries, and performance bonuses. Extrinsic motivation systems are built on the assumption that although work is unpleasant, if you give people external incentives to perform, they will respond productively. People who submit to these extrinsic reward systems are encouraged to develop a merit badge mentality. They get good at complying with other people's standards, following other people's methods, and pursuing other people's goals. People driven by intrinsic motivation are not like that. They are bad at paying attention to what other people tell them to pay attention to. Winston Churchill was a poor student for just this reason. Where my reason, imagination, or interest were not engaged, I would not or I could not learn, he wrote in his autobiography, My Early Life. Early screw-ups. Late bloomers often don't fit into existing systems. To use William Dershowitz's term, they are bad at being excellent sheep, bad at following the conventional rules of success. Or to put it another way, they can be assholes. Buckminster Fuller was expelled from college twice, lost his job in the building business when he was 32, and later contemplated suicide so his family could live off his life insurance. Colonel Sanders was fired for insubordination when he was a railway engineer, and then fired again for brawling with a colleague while working as a fireman. His career as a lawyer ended when he got into a fist fight with a client, and he lost his job as an insurance salesman because he was unsuited to working for other people. Then, at 62, he created the recipe for what became Kentucky Fried Chicken, began to succeed as a franchisor at 69, and sold the company for $2 million when he was 73. Diversive curiosity. Our culture pushes people to specialize early. Be like Tiger Woods driving golf balls as a toddler. Concentrate on one thing and get really good really fast. Yet when the journalist David Epstein looked at the lives of professional athletes, he found that most of them were less like Tiger Woods and more like Roger Federer, who played a lot of different sports when he was young. Many late bloomers endure a brutal wandering period as they cast about for a vocation. Julia Child made hats, worked for the U.S. intelligence, where she was part of a team trying to develop an effective shark repellent, and thought about trying to become a novelist before enrolling in a French cooking school at 37. During these early periods, late bloomers try and then quit so many jobs that the people around them might conclude that they lack resilience. But these are exactly the years when the late bloomers are developing what psychologists call diversive curiosity, the ability to wander into a broad range of interest in a manner that seems to have no rhyme or reason. The benefit of this kind of curiosity might be hard to see in the short term, but they become obvious once the late bloomer begins to take advantage of their breadth of knowledge by putting discordant ideas together in new ways. The ability to self-teach. Late bloomers don't find their calling until they are too old for traditional education systems, so they have to teach themselves. Successful autodidacts start with what psychologists call a high need for cognition. In other words, they like to think a lot. Leonardo da Vinci is the poster child for high cognition needs. Consider his famous list of self-assigned research projects. Ask the master of arithmetic how to square a triangle, examine a crossbow, ask about the measurement of the sun, draw Milan. Benjamin Franklin was similar. After he was appointed U.S. ambassador to France, he could have relaxed on his transatlantic voyages between home and work. Instead, he turned them into scientific expeditions, measuring the temperature of the water as he went, which allowed him to discover and chart the Gulf Stream. The mind of the explorer. By middle age, many late bloomers have achieved liftoff and are getting to enjoy the pleasures of concentrated effort. They are absorbed, fascinated, but since they are freer from ties and associations than the early achiever, late bloomers can also change their mind and update their models without worrying about betraying any professional norms. The secret of life is to have a task, something you devote your entire life to, something you bring everything to every minute of the day for the rest of your life. The sculptor Henry Moore once told the poet Donald Hall, and the most important thing is, it must be something you cannot possibly do. Wisdom. After a lifetime of experimentation, some late bloomers transcend their craft or career and achieve a kind of comprehensive wisdom. Wisdom is a complicated trait. It starts with pattern recognition, using experience to understand what is really going on. But the trait we call wisdom is more than just pattern recognition. It's the ability to see things from multiple points of view, the ability to aggregate perspectives and rest in the tensions between them. When he was in his 60s, Cezanne built a study in Provence and painted a series of scenes of a single mountain, Mount Saint-Victor, which are now often considered his greatest works. But he wasn't so much painting the mountain as painting time. He was also painting perception itself, its continual flow, its uncertainties and evolutions. "I progress very slowly," he wrote to the painter Emile Bernard, "for nature reveals herself to me in complex ways, and the progress needed is endless." When I was young, I was mentored by William F. Buckley and Milton Friedman, both at that time approaching the end of their careers. Both men had changed history. Buckley created the modern conservative movement that led to the election of Ronald Reagan. Friedman changed economics and won the Nobel Prize. I had a chance to ask each of them separately if they ever felt completion, If they ever had a sense that they'd done their work and now they could had crossed the finish line and could relax. Neither man even understood my question. They were never at rest, pushing for what they saw as a better society all the days of their lives. I've noticed this pattern again and again. Slow at the start, late bloomers are still sprinting during that final lap. They do not slow down as age brings its decay. They are seeking, they are striving, they are in it with all their heart. This was adapted from an article first published in The Atlantic. I'd like to share two of the obituaries with you today. Both were sort of self-help pop culture folks from the 70s that I remember well. The workout guru who spurred us to sweat. Richard Simmons, 1948 to 2024. Richard Simmons' life was changed by a note left on his car windshield. At the time, he was a 270-pound exchange student in Italy who'd parlayed his rotund appearance into roles in TV commercials and a Fellini film. "Fat people die young," read the note. "Please don't die." Horrified, Simmons transformed himself through diet and exercise, then rose to fame exhorting others to do the same. Clad in sequined tops and skimpy shorts, the hyperkinetic Pied Piper of pounds was America's top workout guru in the 1980s, writing best-selling diet books, hosting a syndicated workout show, and selling tens of millions of workout videos such as Sweatin' to the Oldies. With relentless campy energy, he donned tutus, chanted, "Fat, fat, go away, give it all to Doris Day," and hectored his subjects to sweat harder. "People need the court jester," he said in 2012, "so I keep that smile on and keep going out there to do what I do." Simmons was born into showbiz in New Orleans, where his father was an MC and his mother a dancer, said the Los Angeles Times. Selling pralines as a child, Simmons learned to charm customers, but struggled with his weight and was taunted in school. He was studying art in Florence when he was discovered. He then appeared in more than 130 commercials, playing parts including a dancing meatball. Once he decided to lose weight, he turned first to pills and fasting, but after his health cratered, he became devoted to healthy eating and exercise. Moving to Los Angeles, he opened Slimmons, an exercise studio, in 1974, said NBCNews.com. His flamboyant personality attracted celebrity fans and the notice of TV producers. Soon he was a regular on TV talk shows and a celebrity in his own right. Simmons led classes into his mid-60s, said the Washington Post. But in 2014, he abruptly withdrew from public life, spawning rumors and conspiracy theories, amplified by a podcast, Missing Richard Simmons, that offered tabloid speculation. In terse social media posts, he referenced health issues. This year, he said he'd been treated for skin cancer and told followers to enjoy your life to the fullest. That message was a continuation of his life's mission, to inspire and empower. "When I'm long dead and gone," he said in 2006, "it will still be love yourself, watch your portions, and move your buns." And the other one, the feisty therapist who taught America to talk about sex. Ruth Westheimer, 1928. 2024. For Dr. Ruth, no question was taboo. A dynamo at 4'7", she became in her 50s America's first mass market sex guru, building an empire of radio and television shows, self-help books, and speaking engagements. When she burst onto the scene in the 1980s, public discussion of sex was shrouded in prudishness. But Dr. Ruth disarmed critics with her humor and her twinkly grandmother persona, fearlessly discussing everything from premature ejaculation to oral sex in heavily accented English. "When it comes to sex," she often said, "the most important 6 inches are the ones between your ears." Born Carola Ruth Siegel, she grew up in Frankfurt, Germany, attending synagogue with her father, a notions wholesaler. When the Nazis arrested him in 1938, Ruth was sent to a Swiss school, said The Guardian, and never saw her parents again. She assumed they died in the Holocaust. At 17, she went to what was then Palestine to become a sniper and a scout for the Israeli cause. At 22, she studied psychology at the Sorbonne and then moved to the U.S. After her first two marriages failed, she met her life partner, Manfred Westheimer, while earning a doctorate in education at Columbia University. She became Dr. Ruth in 1980 when a public radio producer heard her lecture and offered her a talk show. Sexually speaking was a sensation, and she became a regular guest on Late Night and launched the Lifetime TV show Good Sex in 1984. Overexposure and competition eventually cut into her popularity, said the New York Times, but late in life, she was named New York's ambassador for loneliness. Her prescription for the lonely was the same as for the sexually frustrated. "Be open. You have to feel your emotions," she said. "If you bottle the sadness in, the joy gets bottled right along with it." And we've time for one of the Talking Points articles. Abortion. Has the GOP gone wobbly? Donald Trump this week essentially told pro-lifers to take a hike, said Alexandria DeSantis in National Review. Delegates at the Republican National Convention approved a new party platform, but the call for a federal abortion ban, a constant in Republican platforms for the last 40 years, was nowhere to be found. In fact, the word abortion appeared only once in the 16-page document. The platform echoes Trump's stance that abortion should be left up to the states, which it says are free to pass laws protecting the right to life guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. The GOP platform also explicitly supports access to contraception and in vitro fertilization, despite the pro-life belief that these procedures kill fertilized eggs. Many anti-abortion activists feel rightly betrayed. Their work to overturn Roe v. Wade is now being reversed by a Trump-induced effort to be rid of the topic for good because of the mistaken notion that it's an electoral liability. The platform's moderation is a lie, said Jill Filipovich in CNN.com. Trump knows abortion remains the party's weakest issue, and the near-total bans in red states have proven wildly unpopular. To avoid alienating swing voters, he wants to avoid the topic and to distance himself from Project 2025, the detailed plan for a second Trump presidency that calls for reversing federal approval of abortion medications and severely restricting abortion access. Trump knows that most Americans support abortion rights, and as he recently said about the topic, "You have to get elected." But his core support comes from hardline Christian conservatives, and once he regains power, he is likely to do the extreme anti-abortion movement's bidding. That movement has a specific plan for a national ban, said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times. its lodestar is using the 14th Amendment, passed to guarantee rights to freed slaves, to provide a constitutional guarantee of fetal personhood, which would outlaw abortion in every state. In coming years, the right-wing activist on the Supreme Court may adopt that radical reinterpretation, said Susan Rinkinus in Slate. Republicans are also counting on the court or Trump to revive enforcement of the 19th century Comstock Act, which bans the mailing of abortion tools and medications. Trump and the GOP are engaging in a long con to appeal to centrists while winking and nodding to any abortion activists that once he's reelected, all bets are off. And a short note or two. The IRS has collected $1 billion in back taxes from millionaires since 2023. The collection effort, which followed an $80 billion funding boost for the agency in the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act, focused on 1,600 individuals who had failed to pay their recognized tax debt. 56% of divorced men plan to vote for Donald Trump in November, according to a survey Center of American Life, compared with 50% of married men and 38% of single men. And we'll finish today's show with a quote from Benjamin Franklin, who says, "Creditors have better memories than debtors." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Hope you have enjoyed it. Please listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.